Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
In front of a live studio audience, it's everyone's favorite podcast that's recorded at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, the Short Coat Podcast. We're coming to you this time from the Examine Life Conference, our annual international meeting that deals with the intersections between the arts and medicine. And by international, I mean that we welcome people from any country, but we actually get people from Canada and, for some reason, Australia. Our loyal listeners know me as their host, Dave Etler, but it also happens that I coordinate this three-day conference. And late last year, as we were getting ready to send out the call for presentations, I told myself something very, very dumb. I said to myself, Dave, we should do a show in front of people. And now that I'm here doing that show, I'm so nervous that I've just realized that by the time we're done recording today, I'm going to have to buy the college a new chair. So, but it's too late. We're here. I'll just introduce my co-presenters. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for third-year medical student, Mr. Eric Wilson. Next up, let's welcome second-year med student, Ms. Lisa Weir. Show your appreciation for second-year med student, Mr. Matt Maves.
Hi.
And what podcast would be complete without some applause for our first-year, Mr. Ethan Craig? So today represents a chance to talk on the show with some folks who really are at the margins of medicine, a selection of presenters from this conference to find out what they're doing where art meets medicine. We've got four of them here with us today. So let's start with our first guest. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome ER doc and filmmaker Gabriel Ledger. It's just what I do. So, Gabriel, you're a filmmaker. And your film that you've made follows two patients, Ashley and Presley, seen in the ER after the traumas that brought them there. Presley was nearly killed in an assault,
right.
And Ashley was severely injured in a motor vehicle accident. And they describe what happened to them, their injuries and their recoveries. Why did you want to do this?
I was a resident in New Mexico, and I had taken care of a lot of trauma patients as a resident in the ER and also working on the trauma surgery service. And it was a couple of years later, I did those rotations in my first and second year, and then in my third year, I had a curiosity about what happened to all those patients. What happened to the guy who was dragged by a car? What happened to that guy who fell out of the hot air balloon? The woman who was run over by a ram? And I decided to find out. I decided to take a drive around New Mexico and visit as many of my former patients as I could find.
Do you think that's a sort of an unusual thing among you and your colleagues in emergency medicine to go, hey, what happened to these people? Or is it something that you all think about in the back of your head?
I think we would probably want to know what happened to our patients, but yeah, the truth is, I think once they're out of sight, a lot of times patients are out of mind from the ER. But I think that's a shame. I think it's nice to know what happened to people. And then what's really nice is to ask them, what was it like for you? What was it like for you in the ER? What was it like for you in the hospital? And then when you get to see someone 2 years later, what's it been like for you in recovery?
I just was curious, not to jump in here, but you said one of your patients was run over by a ram. Did you mean like a Dodge Ram or like a ram, like animal?
Yeah.
Okay. I just was curious. That sounds like a story that you'd want to follow up. So.
Yeah, she was a rancher. She was a 90-year-old rancher, she and her husband still ran the ranch, and they had a ram, which they called a bad attitude ram. And
I think if you're going to get run over by a ram, it's probably going to be one with a bad attitude.
It certainly was. So this ram apparently had her husband in its sights and was going to make a run at her husband, and she actually stepped in front to try to keep the ram from getting to her husband, and she got hit and it broke her leg.
Wow. So what did you have a process in mind when you started this, or was it just, you know, I'm going to do this? And then, I mean, how did you plan this out? Because I just want to say that, like, doing this as you've seen today, it's complicated, and so you add video or film on top of that, and man,
it started out just the stories. I just wanted to hear the stories, and I initially just drove around to people with a digital voice recorder, and I was just recording the stories. stories. And to be honest, I didn't know really what I was going to do with it. There was a little bit of a qualitative research component to it. So I asked them about some pain scales and some recovery scales. But to be honest, that was to satisfy my residency. I wasn't really that interested in the research aspect of it. And then it was once I had all the stories collected and they were sort of percolating in my mind that I ended up at I actually ended up at a music concert in Albuquerque of a musician who was a refugee from Iraq who had come to the United States and had settled in Albuquerque. And listening to his music, it told the story of these patients' traumas. And it just sort of all kind of came together while I was sitting in this concert. And I sort of saw the pictures of a film. And that's what started the film project. And I didn't even think about all the technology and things that I didn't know.
You artists.
Yeah, I was going to ask, did you have any experience in anything like this before you started, or was it kind of learning on the fly?
Yeah, it was completely learning on the fly. I didn't really know anything about film at all, and I'm not even that much of a techie, to be honest. So I wrote a grant, and I got lucky to get just a little bit of money that allowed me to hire one professional person, and he was a cinematographer. And so he ran the camera, but he also knew how to collect tapes and how to label tapes and how to organize shots and how to basically help me organize the project.
So I want to ask about the patients. The people you interviewed, were they reluctant to be involved? Were they excited to be? What were their initial thoughts on this?
They loved it. There was only one patient. I think I contacted about 45 patients in the process of finding them for interviews, and only one patient didn't want to participate. Actually, that was one of the most remarkable findings, is that they loved talking to someone. They loved the fact that someone from the hospital would come and find them and ask them about how they were and how they had recovered. It was amazing. You really couldn't stop them from talking, actually, once you started getting their stories.
So why do you think they were willing to tell their stories? I mean, okay, so a little personal background here. I've been in the ER, and I don't want to necessarily talk about it. I mean, what?
I think that's part of it. I think a lot of people have a very conflicted experience with their ER visit and with their hospitalization. I think, especially trauma patients, they're very appreciative that something was done in the moment to save their lives. And they realize that. But they also felt that things could have been better. They felt that people ignored them. They felt that people didn't listen to their pain. They felt that people talked over them and didn't really talk to them. And that continues. That's in the ER. That continues through the hospitalization. And then you're kicked out of the hospital and you're sent off to rehab somewhere. And I think they have this unifying experience that maybe nobody really cares about what happens after we do the acute life-saving in the emergency department. And I think when you then ask them, well, what was it like for you? They actually have a story that hasn't been told, and they are very excited to tell it.
So is that what you started out to say in this film, or did that was just something you realized? I mean, I'm sure, like, you knew that, you know, patients don't necessarily feel like, you know, they as a person are the center of attention in the ER or in the hospital, that it's more their condition. But was that something you wanted to say, or was that something that just came out?
I think the only thing I wanted to say starting out was to give them a voice, to let them tell their stories. But then once I started to hear their stories, I realized that they had a lot to teach us in the hospital, sort of bringing that full circle. They could tell us better how to take care of them in the future. And that's what I learned by listening to their stories and then going back and filming.
What did the process sort of do for you as a physician and a person? So what was there a practical side to this when you were done? Like, it made you a better emergency medicine doctor? Or
I think, well, first of all, it definitely, it just was interesting to me. It energized me. I was excited, actually, to go back to work because I realized I'd be seeing people who eventually were going to have stories. And it sort of made me more interested to see the patients that I was seeing on a day-to-day basis and take care of those trauma patients. But I think in a long term, and this is something that I didn't realize when I finished the project, but as I've worked for a few years since the project, is that it really gave me an appreciation for the stories that they have and the importance of us, we in the medical system, listening to their stories, and the fact that communication, listening to stories, giving patients the opportunity to express themselves is something that we can use as medical providers to help improve our delivery of care and therefore kind of improve the health system overall.
So does that work in emergency medicine then?
I think it does. People say, oh, you can't make a connection with someone. You're in the ER. You see 30 patients a day in the ER. But it's not true. You really can. You can make a connection with someone in a second. I just had a patient a few months ago who I walked into the room. All I said was, Hi, my name is Gabriel Ledger. I'm one of the emergency room doctors, and I must have had a little bit of extra energy that day or something. But the guy, he said, you know, I'm going to tell you what I'm here for in just a second, but I just want to say the way you walked into that room, you already made me feel so much more comfortable. And I felt, great, well, my job is done here. So it's really true. You can make a connection with people in very few moments. And we have very few moments in the emergency room, but it's still possible.
So do you have plans to do more, or are you tired?
It was a hard project.
Yeah.
I actually have more footage. The film is of two patients that I got stories from and recorded. I actually have footage of three more patients, two of whom I followed up and one of whom I actually picked up moving forward. So if I get the time to go back and edit those stories, that's something I'd like to do.
All right. No pressure.
You know, you could do a video podcast. Yes.
The thought is in the works.
Thank you very much for sitting down with us for a few minutes and talking to us.
Thanks very much.
Gabriel Ledger.
So next up, we'll have Tony Becker come forward. So Tony is completing her degree this year in graduate program in speech-language pathology, and she gave a great presentation yesterday talking about using portraits and photographs of people with disabilities to kind of advocate for them. And, well, I'm sure you can talk about it a lot better than I can. So I'll let you just explain a little more about what your project is.
All right, so I'm doing a series of black and white portraits of people with different disabilities and sharing their stories using their own art and just personal narratives of what they've been going through.
Cool. So I know that you said that black and white, that really struck me yesterday as the images that you had, I thought, were actually really powerful, because without the color in them, you kind of focused a lot on, I thought, the features of the people's faces, and really I got a lot out of their expressions. I was wondering if black and white was a choice you consciously made, or?
Yeah, and I wanted to kind of keep everything level across patients without much distraction in the background. So for most of the portraits, I have just a plain background, and the focus is really on, you know, what they might be experiencing and showing, you know, in their face and their posture and that.
I noticed you didn't use any Instagram filters.
I didn't use any Instagram filters. No, they're very minimally processed, so just a little bit of messing with the light, and I just wanted to show them how they are, or how, you know, other people see them, how they see themselves.
And so I remember you mentioned yesterday that you were really inspired at around the time of last year's conference when Andrew Solomon came, and you were inspired by his work. And I was just wondering if that kind of gave you a direction for where you wanted to go, or?
Yeah, so last year's conference really inspired me after hearing his talk and reading his book, Far From the Tree. And one thing that was really powerful to me was that he said the anomalous is not necessarily the pathological. And I thought, that's true. And how do we define pathology? And so I was looking at these different, these populations that he looked at in his book. And I'm like, well, how can I do something to kind of show, you know, what they're feeling and tell their stories, just like he did, but through a visual media.
So in your program in speech-language pathology, I know this project is kind of outside of your graduate work, but I'm wondering if there's anything that you've taken from your project and you now use in your professional career, or if it could be the other way around too.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, my first subject was a friend of the family named Trickett, and she had ALS. And, you know, we've all heard of ALS through the Ice Bucket Challenge, and a lot of you as medical professionals, you're familiar with what it is, but I knew the symptoms that present in clinic, but I never knew about these individuals' personal stories. So hearing Trickett's personal story, the things that she struggled with, and how she, you know, she had a very positive outlook on life despite all of that. It was really, it was a great experience for me to hear that. And so when I see patients that have the same sort of disability, you know I need to hear their story, and it makes me think of them more as individuals, not just saying these are your symptoms and this is how we're going to get around that.
What sort of reactions have you been getting from the patients that have been going through this?
Mm-hmm. They feel very positively about the project because they want to get their stories out. So after I show them the pictures, I mean, my favorite reaction, the one that I would like to get with everybody, is that, you know, they felt understood and they felt beautiful after the photo shoot, whether or not they'd seen the photos. So that's what I'm going for. I want to get, you know, all of their stories out, especially the stories that are less heard for illnesses that people don't talk about publicly.
I've heard that before. We interviewed somebody a long time ago, Rick Guidotti, I think is how you pronounce his name. It's been a long time.
but he took photos of people in Africa with albinism, and said the same thing, you know, like you take pictures of people and they suddenly feel, especially in a, like a photo shoot, like a real photo shoot kind of context.
Yeah.
It makes people really, I don't know, feel good about themselves mm-hmm. for some reason.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Exactly. And I mean, a lot of people don't get that opportunity to, you know, I feel like a model, the attention's all on me, and they really feel like someone's seeing them.
You know, they always talk about, so in lectures and in medical books and stuff, we always see pictures of, you know, the blanked out eyes standing in anatomic position type of thing, and it's you know, it's usually a very unflattering position, and it's I would assume very uncomfortable for the person being photographed. So I imagine getting something that they feel good about afterwards not only benefits the provider who gets to see a person who, I mean, normally you're not going to go up to a person, they're going to be standing in anatomic position. Mm-hmm. So it's not only good for the provider, I would think, but also self-esteem of patient.
Yeah, and that was one of the really important things to me, is that, you know, we're always seeing, so lots of times we see the anatomical position, or we see tragedy in mm-hmm. these different disabilities or disorders. Or we see something that's very triumphant, and we see, you know, these extremes, very happy and very sad, but nothing really in the middle showing the complexities of who they are. So, you know, they have really good times and they have really bad times, and sometimes they have a very complicated relationship with their disability. And that's one thing that I wanted to make sure I showed.
Are you displaying them somewhere, or do you have plans to display them somewhere?
Yeah, I want to. So I'm actually moving. I wanted to do something here before I move, but I'm moving next month. So once I get to my next destination, then I'll seek out appropriate places to display the photos.
I'm curious too, so this being like a medical humanities conference and presenting here, what sorts of things did you want your audience to take out of it, or what things would you want people in the healthcare fields to take from your work?
I think it could serve as just, you know, a reminder that these patients that we see day after day, you know, we read their case histories, and we're like, we know what this is, and we know, you know, how we can try to fix it, but just keeping in mind that they're going to have an array of difficulties, and they're going to have a story that they want their medical, you know, care providers to hear. You know, they want to be understood. So I think it's important to, you know, remember that these are very complex individuals, as opposed to just like seeing this disorder in front of you.
I know one of the things in your presentation that was powerful for me was you had some portraits that had text associated with them, either both on your board out front where there were quotes or people had written things. And so to me, it seems like it's more than just the images, that with the story associated with it, we get a much more kind of deeper understanding of what's going on. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if you had any comments about that.
Yeah, no, I think the images without the text are not worth a whole lot, because they're just portraits, right? So I think it's very important to know the background behind them as well, and hear what these individuals have to say.
Yeah, I felt like it gave me kind of insight into some of the people, because some of them you would look at and you wouldn't say that this person has any disability just visually, because there's mental illness or other things that could not be as visible. And so I thought that was helpful,
yeah,
to bring that out. That,
and I have some video footage of some of them as well, but I am not a cinematographer. I don't know how to edit videos. I would love to turn that into a project later on if I could. But yeah, I think it's important to hear their narrative. That's what I wanted to show everybody.
Thank you.
You know, I just wanted to say that, you know, we've had visual artists come and present, you know, put stuff up here at the conference before. This year, what was exciting was to see a whole bunch of people come with visual stuff, and it's all amazing. So I want to thank you and the other people who brought their visual work because I like visual stuff as much as I like writing, and it's very cool. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right.
Yeah,
thanks.
All right, well, up next we have joining us Emily White, who is a undergraduate student here at the University of Iowa. Emily was at the conference presenting yesterday. She was in charge of a panel discussion titled Dignity Therapy Narrative at End of Life, which right there alone gets me interested, mostly because I, before talking to Emily, had no idea what dignity therapy was. And briefly, she describes it as a psychosocial intervention at the end of life, but I'm betting she could give a much better explanation. So, Emily, why don't you get us started there?
So, dignity therapy is, in its most basic form, is a conversation that you take from the
conversation to a text and from text to a narrative. So what that means is I record conversations with patients that are guided by the Dignity Therapy Framework, which was designed by a Canadian physician named Dr. Harvey Chochnov. And so I would transcribe all of the conversation verbatim and then have various edits of that document, trying to remove my voice as much as possible and put the patient's thoughts kind of together in a coherent manner that they can't do right now because of their energy level at the end of their life.
Fantastic. So when did this get started?
The therapy or my project?
The therapy.
The therapy. So it's interesting because the literature, it's been in the literature for a while. It hasn't really picked up very much. And so in part, I think it's because they haven't seen necessarily the increase in, or I guess increase in depression score sounds counterintuitive, but you know, like those kinds of things quantitatively.
Right.
However, in terms of quality of life, everyone has had an increased quality of life, and the families especially really benefit from the therapy.
Okay. And now, how did you find yourself in this topic?
So I kind of did a really big loop to get to where I am now. When I started out here, I did not think I would be inclined to the humanities at all. And then as I progressed through my education, I just noticed, like you've heard before, patient voices are really absent from healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that was really concerning for me because it felt like the people that know best and the people that really are so isolated by their illness, and they're kept quiet. And the way that they could be left, you know, unisolated by their illness is through sharing their stories. And then additionally, quality of life seemed not to be a huge priority in medicine. This basically came from the results of my other research study, which I work with Dr. Terry Walls in internal medicine. And it's a non-pharmacologic intervention for multiple sclerosis patients. All of them had improvements in quality of life. However, not all of them had functional improvements. For me, I was just like, well, quality of life is huge, especially with MS patients. They're fatigued, they can't, you know, walk around, they can't interact as much. And so to have other people kind of react when I was so excited, not as excited, it was kind of really just like, what are you talking about? I mean, these people feel better. And so that kind of led me to palliative care, and because it blew me away that palliative care's goal was to improve quality of life. And then from palliative care, I found hospice care, because those are, you know, interrelated but different. And through both of those, I kind of got involved in narrative medicine, which is a type of medicine developed kind of by Rita Sharon at Columbia, their medical school. But it's really emphasizing careful listening, developing a more introspective sense of self as a physician, because there's reciprocity and recognition in listening to your patients. So then, full circle.
All right. You did say it was a long circle.
So I promise it will go back. So when I found Dignity Therapy, I found something that introduced patients' voices into healthcare, that improved quality of life, that was associated with palliative and hospice medicine and everything that I wanted to do. And so it was really just the entire circle kind of made a loop at that point. And I hope to continue doing this because I think it's really important to put patients' voices in healthcare.
Fascinating. And I think, yeah, that absolutely echoes what we just heard, and that visually that patients don't feel seen and also don't feel heard. So that's a huge area that I think, as far as patient satisfaction, but really truly just an emotional health that relates to physical health, where we can improve.
It's interesting because I've never worked with photography, but I know at the Hardin Library, I found this book. It was from 1979, and it had pictures of patients and their stories. Mm-hmm. And so in part, you know, a HIP is a great thing. You're protecting patients, you're protecting the information, but it also kind of makes them anonymous and leaves people's information about patient and patienthood and illness to the media and to their imagination. Mm-hmm. And just one of the best pictures was, it was a girl that she was on dialysis full time, but her doctor suggested she get a moped to increase her, like, her, you know, just happiness, and she's just riding that moped. So it's fantastic.
Be the first time a doctor ever said, hey, you should get a moped.
That being said, I don't think I've ever seen a picture of someone looking unhappy on a moped.
It's absolutely true.
I did kind of want to backtrack a little bit just about you. This seems like a lot of insight coming from an undergraduate student. We won't talk about what I did as an undergraduate, but I'm very impressed.
Sure, you were very insightful.
Thank you. So was there a defining moment, a patient, a story, something that struck you, that awoke this in you?
I kind of started reading a lot about healthcare in the UK, actually. And how their government is so on board with patient stories. And there's a research group at Oxford that's called Health Experience Research Group. They publish just all of these patient stories. They have a sister site that's children's stories. So kind of through that, and then as I got more involved in the hospital, you know, there are certain things that, and this is where some people called me naive or idealistic or whatever, and they meant it kind of as an insult, but for me it was kind of, you know, idealism is power, because nothing gets better without an idea. Mm. And so when I was in the hospital, there were certain things that I couldn't reason through, and when I would ask certain, you know, people, they'd just be, that's the way the system works, that's just how it is. Mm. And that's a cop-out, because we construct the system.
Absolutely.
And so that's kind of where the MD-JD thing comes in, which I want to pursue, hopefully, because it's a lot easier to blame physicians, and I think physicians are getting a lot of the blame when it's really the system, and the system's invisible to everyone else.
Right.
So to have physician input in legislation and policy, I think, is really important.
Absolutely. I think we are the advocates for our patients on that level, so pursuing that kind of avenue, I think, hopefully will stir a lot of conversation and some change.
And I think the defining moment for me was when I took a global health class, actually.
Okay.
Because up until that point, illness and disease had been presented to me as exclusively and fundamentally biological. And this class explored the collective dimensions of suffering and how people make sense of their illness. And it was just, I realized how much, you know, how many different forces, be it cultural, social, historical, converge in a person alongside with their biology to form their sense of illness. So you can look at, you know, someone and see just an alcoholic, for example, or you could look backwards and see, you know, the conquistadors coming into Puerto Rico and paying them with alcohol, and that being a kind of payment and fulfillment for them, and then they migrated to New York, and then, you know, so there's a lot of history that goes in. They were unoccupied, or sorry, not like in a job, and so then they started to drink too, because there's a disproportionate amount of alcoholism
right.
in certain demographics. They started to drink as a way to maintain their sense of self, because that was how they were paid formally. Mm-hmm. So you can look at the superficial, but there's a lot more often going on, and careful listening and narrative medicine and dignity therapy allowed me to kind of listen to either what's not being said, listen to the way the person's telling me the story, like why did they start with this detail, and so on and so forth. So it's very analytical, I guess.
Absolutely. Okay, so the big message, patients have things to say, and there's a way to do it, but how do you make this systemic? How do you get a hospital on board or a clinic on board?
I think with dignity therapy, the fact that in 57% of euthanasia cases, physicians cite dignity loss as contributing to them seeking out euthanasia. I think that fact alone makes it relevant to the system as it currently exists, because you have people not wanting to live anymore because they don't have a sense of self. Additionally, a sub-theme of the dignity therapy framework is hopefulness, and hopelessness is actually a very important marker of suicidal ideation. And so we have a really general understanding of dignity in healthcare, just it's associated with respect, honor, and esteem. Mm-hmm. But having a definition doesn't go past just saying, this is dignity, this is someone without dignity. You have to understand that person's sense of self and how they experience dignity within their own illness experience to help them maintain it or prevent them from losing it. And that's what makes dignity therapy so special to me, is Dr. Chochnov did a study basically asking patients at end of life, what does dignity mean to you? Can it be taken away? And their perceptions form the framework. Every single theme and sub-theme within this model has a clinical correlate that suggests an area of attention that could mitigate suffering at end of life.
Absolutely. Very interesting.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to say that, you know, one of the things you mentioned before struck me, which is something about, you know, the functional improvement versus the quality of life improvement, and how, you know, you are often sort of, you know, thinking about, you know, quantitative measures and things like that. But there's, you know, I think we in this room probably realize that there's, you know, way more to medicine than just the quantitative.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was interesting to me.
And that's what my thesis is kind of looking at, is the qualitative aspects of this therapy, because we have quantitative measurements, the psychometric battery of questions that you give patients, but dignity is so individualized mm-hmm. that you have to look at their stories and you have to draw those qualitative correlates, because they aren't without purpose. You know, they really can inform you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Emily White, everybody.
All right, our next guest is Dr. Susan Ball, who is an associate professor at Cornell, and where she teaches narrative medicine along with other responsibilities. She also is the assistant director of the designated AIDS Care Center at New York Presbyterian Hospital, where she has cared for HIV/AIDS patients for over 20 years. And so, well, we're kind of on the topic of narrative medicine. I wonder if you had anything to add, any insights on narrative medicine.
Well, being an HIV care provider, I think over the years I've been not increasingly aware, but perpetually aware of how my patients' stories impact the care that they get. And certainly in my experiences as an AIDS care provider, I've heard many, many patient stories over the end. How we react to those stories, how we interact with those stories really can lead to better care, I think, if we can listen and appreciate how much a patient's illness narrative is an aspect of their whole lives. If we can connect with that story, we can provide better care. So I've sort of made a little segue in my career. I'm still a full-time practicing clinician, but learning more about narrative medicine and wanting to teach it and spending time teaching it, I think it's allowed me to reach out to other providers, as well as to students, as well as to my own patients, and understand their stories better, and ideally help hopefully provide better care.
So, speaking about this, I was going to mention this earlier too, but part of the reason you're here, you're doing a reading for your book that just came out not too long ago, which is Voices in the Band, A Doctor, Her Patients, and How the Outlook on AIDS Care Changed from Doom to Hopeful. So before we talk about that, do you feel that part of the reason you wanted to write a book is because of your background in narrative medicine?
Absolutely. Well, I should say my interest in writing the book was really to talk about these stories of patients. I came to understand that my affinity for patient stories, we could now define it, or we could put it under the rubric of narrative medicine. So I actually got involved with the narrative medicine program in 2009 at Columbia. So narrative medicine is always infused throughout medical care, but I think we didn't really have the name narrative medicine until later on. So, you know, I've been an AIDS clinician for a long time, but again, coming to narrative medicine a little later allowed me a pathway to not only put together the book, but also to see how importantly these patient stories impacted all of us, and how better understanding of the stories could help us take better care of the patient.
So I've been reading your book lately, and it kind of struck me. Yeah, it struck me as very interesting. I know that
he's lying.
No,
it's true.
I've been working my way through it. I mean, board studying's on the mind, but I've been working my way.
It's
through.
It's riveting, right?
It is. I mean, obviously the beginning is obviously a little bit hard to read, since it's the beginning of your AIDS treatment, and it's before we had a lot of effective treatments. So there are a lot of sad stories to be heard. But one of the things that struck me right in the beginning was discussing not only such personal things about the patients, but also some of your coworkers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, was that difficult for you to put that down in writing, knowing that there was a good chance that a lot of these people would probably read it in the future?
there was nothing too exposing about my coworkers, but that was also a big reason why I wanted to write the book, because, you know, it wasn't just me taking care of a patient. It was a time when our multidisciplinary approach to patient care was really so fundamental and so important, especially in those really dark times of caring for AIDS patients. You know, so many of our patients died, and so many people were so terribly sick. Having a team to work with, having social workers and nurses and nutritionists and a chaplain, psychiatrists, all of these people contributed to the care of the patients at a time when we really did not have effective medication, you know, to treat the HIV. Instead, we had this team to provide care, and working with that team really helped all of us do our jobs better, because the intensity and the sadness of some of these situations could be overwhelming for us individually, but together I think we could really not only care for the patients, but care for each other. So that was, for me anyway, a very important part of the book, was writing about this team approach and how how much it, again, helped patients, but how it helped us as well.
So can I ask something about that time when we didn't know much?
Yeah, sure.
Was it terrifying? As a non-medical professional, I have little to relate to, but I'm always on the knife edge of terror about my own job, and so I can just imagine like not knowing what to do or not knowing how to help people would be just kind of an awful thing.
You know,
or were you professionally detached or something? You know,
not detached. We knew by 1984, 85 what HIV was. You know, before it was this illness, people were dying, but then the virus was discovered. It was very definitively proven that it was transmitted through blood and body fluid. So sexual transmission, sharing needles, really direct blood-to-blood contact. So I was not in any danger taking care of my patients with HIV. I remember when I started my job, my parents were like, you know, are you going to get AIDS? And I said, Dad, I'm not going to get AIDS because I'm not planning to have sex with my patients. And, you know, and they were like, ha, you're so funny.
Yeah, I think there's that's a good point.
that was about their response. Yeah. But no, really, I mean, that there was so much fear because of the initial not knowing how this virus was transmitted, and also a little bit because of the patient population. In the early days, there was still a tremendous amount of homophobia in the United States, and it was initially really a disease of gay men and then also drug users. So the clientele was a group of people who were marginalized in our society, and that also, you know, engendered a lot of fear and you know, ignorance does not bring out the best in people in many cases.
So speaking of that, so when you started practicing medicine, you know, after your residency and stuff, that was still the very early stages of our AIDS treatment. What kind of drew you to that? Because at that time, it was pretty much a death sentence.
Well, you know, there was a lot that was unknown, and that was intriguing. And also there was a sense, you know, so many of these patients were isolated. They were put in rooms by themselves. The food workers didn't want to bring them their food trays. Many patients were isolated from their families or their communities. And that, I thought, you know, these people needed our help. It wasn't me alone, but there were others who were sort of drawn to taking care of these patients, and I liked those people as well. So, you know, there was a real community of people who were engaged in taking care of patients with HIV. It wasn't all of medicine. I think, it brought out some of the best and worst aspects of medical care, but I was drawn to taking care of these people. And there was no script. You know, a lot of it was we didn't know how to treat it. We didn't know what to do. So there was a lot of doing the best we could in situations where we didn't have specific treatments to offer.
Well, thank you so much for talking.
Can I ask a quick question?
No. Mm-mm.
Please.
All right,
not related to AIDS. You're kind of getting this because you're sort of the last person, but you also teach narrative medicine.
Yes.
So for someone listening to this podcast, be it a med student or physician or, you know, my mother who hears about narrative medicine and thinks...
It's only who listens, but...
Actually, my mother has only recently started listening. you know, hears about narrative medicine and thinks that's really cool. Like, I want to get into it. Do you have advice for people who are maybe just want to get their foot in the door and learn a little more about it, get started in it?
In narrative medicine?
Yes, in narrative medicine.
Well, there's a website, narrativemedicine.org, which is the group in New York at Columbia, because there is a master's program for narrative medicine. And it isn't just doctors by any stretch, because, you know, all of us who care about other people, you know, lawyers could do this, secretaries, anybody who's involved in interacting with other people in some way. Everybody's got a story of an interaction that they've had or a situation where they were involved with someone. So I think, you know, we call it narrative medicine, and that's how it applies directly to me. But I think everybody could benefit from learning more about narrative medicine and learning some of the close listening and reflection that is involved with narrative medicine.
Susan Ball, thank you very much for joining
us. My pleasure.
Thank you.
If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us your moment of truth. If something irritating or amazing happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at shortcode.com/tell us. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. This show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Box, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.